the Vox Markets podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished stock picker Roland Head, one of the UK's finest private investors. So welcome, Roland.
Oh, good morning, Paul, and thanks for having me again. It's good to be with you again.
Yeah, well, lots been happening since we last spoke 6 months ago. And now that sort of inflation is beginning to cool and sort of the markets are expecting central banks to be on hold for a while, what's your sort of outlook for equities as we look into 2024?
Well, I suppose my feeling is that we must be somewhere near the bottom of the market for equities, maybe not the real economy, but I mean, there seems to be a lot of value on offer at the moment. We're seeing lots of takeover bids coming through every week, especially small caps. And I suppose I'm not really a top-down investor in terms of looking at the macro data, but my feeling, I suppose, is that while in the UK, maybe the economy is still slowing a bit, but I would have thought that unless things are going to be much worse than we expect or much worse than I expect, then I think the stock market is really offering some decent value and good medium-term opportunity at the moment. That's certainly how I'm approaching it as an investor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Goldman Sachs actually had their outlook for 2024, and they were pretty positive on the equity outlook. And they sort of highlighted the UK is trading at about sort of like 10 to 10 and a half times PE, which is the cheapest stock market in the world. And I guess the key question for somebody like yourself is, can we believe the earnings to get such a cheap valuation?
Well, you can never be totally certain, but I suppose looking at companies trading, what they say about their trading and the outlook and the general conditions, my kind of default view is that maybe there's a shade of optimism in some of these earnings, but I don't see any reason as things stand to expect them to really collapse. So I'm seeing if you've got a decent margin of safety in terms of the valuation, then I'm not losing too much sleep about the chance of, you know, earnings could be adjusted down a little bit, or that, you know, there'll be some weaknesses and some strengths in different areas. But I suppose a slight spin of optimism, but nothing too much to worry about. That's generally the way I'm looking at earnings, I think.
Yeah. And what do you think would be sort of like a key catalyst to drive UK stock prices higher? And importantly, when do you think it's going to happen?
Well, I mean, I think at the moment, looking at recent results and corporate commentary, it's more as much of a crisis of confidence among investors, I think, as it is actual company performance. Plenty of companies are performing okay, you know, and more importantly, they're doing what they said they'd do. The results are in line, and even then, their share prices still fall. So it's really about finding something that will persuade investors to commit some cash again, rather than only focusing on those outperforming US stocks.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess sort of like if you are sort of going into sort of dividend stocks, which I know is one of your specializations, then hey, if the market goes down a bit further, it doesn't matter because you get paid to wait. That's one of the advantages of your income strategy, I guess.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I'm not too, as long as the companies are doing more or less what I expected them to do, then if the shares go down in the short term, it doesn't, I don't lose a lot of sleep about it. If the dividends continue and I'm getting that income, I can reinvest it at more attractive prices sometimes. So yeah, I think that is one of the strengths of income in a weak market. It's it gives you something tangible to show that, you know, you are getting a return from the investments, they are performing, and that your patience is more likely than not will be rewarded.
Yeah. Or your confidence is not totally battered that you become shell-shocked. No, actually, just on an aside, I guess, outside of equities, given you run that sort of income strategy, have you considered sort of gilts at all? Because, I mean, I've hardly ever bought fixed income, but I actually did sort of like get a 15% weighting in my own personal portfolio on sort of like 16-month, 18-month, 5% gilts. And I just thought, this is just it's almost like a, you know, real high hurdle for equities to beat.
Yeah, I think it's a fair comment. I mean, you're looking at gilts and you can maybe get 5% with basically effectively no risk. And so when you're looking at shares that are yielding 4 or 5% and do carry some risk, always will, then there is that temptation. I suppose for me personally, I don't own any fixed income. It's sort of something I've never got into. I don't really have a lot of knowledge about the area. So for me, I don't own any, but I can see the temptations at the moment. And that's possibly another pressure on stocks. People are saying, well, the shares keep falling, the yield is the same, so I can put my money here and get guaranteed to get my money back and a similar income. And in the short term, that can pay off. But I suppose in the long term, there's not the same opportunity for appreciation and for compounding. And that's ultimately always the appeal of shares for me.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Okay, well, let's just run through some sort of stocks. We've got shipbroker Clarkson that has got a really strong balance sheet. It's got, it seems incredible, actually, about $300 million of cash. I'm not sure if that all that is distributable. It trades at roughly around about just under 12 times PE. And I guess this is really a sort of a GDP play on sort of freight rates and activity and globalization and trade. How do you see this one looking into next year?
Yeah, I think this is one of those, this is probably a good example of what I was saying a few minutes ago. I don't think the profits are about to collapse or anything like that, but I think there might be a little bit of weakness possibly coming in. Because as you say, the performance, the activity levels in the business are really closely tied to GDP and to shipping activity, trade, and all the rest of it. So my view on this business is that this is really one of the market leaders. It's been in business, I think, for about 170 years. It's operated through many cycles, many wars, all sorts of disruption. There may be short-term headwinds, but their exposure across the shipping sector is quite broad. I think they're involved in all the main sectors, all the main parts of the shipping industry. And as you say, the balance sheet looks good. I don't think all of that cash is spare. I think actually some of it is earmarked for bonuses, which are quite substantial in this business for the brokers, I guess. But I think the valuation at the moment looks very reasonable on a historical view. I think it's rarely been this cheap. So again, I feel confident enough in earnings. I've bought a little bit more recently, actually. And I think on a medium-term view, it looks pretty safe at the moment.
Yeah, if it's been around for over 1.5 centuries, then it does sell. It's got some durability and some resilience. So it should, if he's got through a pandemic as well, it should do absolutely fine. And one which is just moved to now to sort of different sector, Zote Phones, which I know Paul Scott from Stockopedian also holds. And it does sort of like in specialists cellular materials and insulation materials and stuff like that. And I understand it's got a sort of flagship contract with Nike. Nike as well for its shoes. Do you want to take us through Zote Phones? Because it's actually done quite well recently.
Yeah, this is a stock I've actually only bought quite recently, and it's in my in the portfolio I run at Stockopedia, which is a kind of model portfolio and more of a growth short-term focus. So it's not necessarily a dividend play that I normally look at. But as you say, a big contract with Nike, which I think is obviously very valuable to the business, but perhaps a bit of a risk in terms of customer concentration. I think around 1/3 of sales and an unknown proportion of profits come from this. So it's worth understanding that. But it seems to be a good business. Some intellectual property, these kind of high-performance foams, I think they're used in airline seats and various other sorts of consumer goods as well. And there's maybe a bit of a blue sky opportunity too. They've got a new recyclable product called Resource, I think, which can be used to make drinks cartons that are the more easily recyclable than the current technology. So I think commercially that's still at an early stage, but it could be an interesting one. And as you say, the valuation looks very good at the moment. It's sold off a lot over the summer. And I think when I looked, it's about a 10% EBIT yield. So I think it looks a nice business. And for the, in the short term, at least, it's a good example of one of these solid small caps, profitable, but at a value rating, I think.
Yeah. I did see just recently their long-term CEO, David Sterling, has decided to sort of step aside. How sort of like significant do you think that is, if at all?
It's always hard to say, isn't it? He's obviously been instrumental in shaping the company, I think, for about 20 years from memory. So there's a degree of transition risk, but it seems to be an orderly handover. You know, he's not rushing out the door. So I wouldn't use it. It wouldn't be a deal breaker for me, but it's something to keep an eye on. That's my general kind of approach, I suppose. Yeah.
And when you've got sort of like a, you know, a person who's synonymous with actual business, he's probably been instrumental in bringing somebody like Nike to the party. So I guess it's sort of making sure that that is sort of like, you know, correctly transitioned, isn't it, into the relevant parties, such that Nike are happy.
I think that relationship is really important. And reading the reporting and the annual report and so on, I think I get the impression they really have a whole team of people who are really focused on just, nurturing that relationship. So as you say, he probably was instrumental in it, but hopefully now there's enough strength across the team to transition that without upsetting the balance. And I do think actually the contract with Nike has recently been extended, I believe. The scope of it has been increased and it's been extended to the end of 2029. So for now, it seems an acceptable sort of risk to have that dependency.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, I think they were sort of like started that relationship in sort of like running shoes, and they've now progressed to sort of like trail shoes, and next year they're into basketball, and I think even into Air Jordan, which is their sort of like their flagship brand. So if Nike are putting them into their best selling sneakers, then it's got to be good, to say the least.
Must be a good product, yeah.
Now another one which is sort of like a perennial, you know, high performer is Intertek, which does all things sort of like certification of products for OEMs and other, you know, sort of product manufacturers. It tests them and it makes sure that they meet all the regulations and all this sort of stuff. How do you see that and it's sort of like competitive advantages? Because I think it makes really good margins as it scales and just keeps growing that competitive moat.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny business. This seems to be one of the least covered FTSE 100 stocks, I'd say. I mean, looked on the Financial Times website the other day, and they don't seem to have mentioned it since 2017. So it's very odd, because as you say, it's as a high performer, really, over a long time, generates return on capital employed is typically around 20%. It generates plenty of cash, and it's been able to expand really through a mixture of organic growth and rolling up lots of small specialist companies and a few larger acquisitions. So to me, it's more of the structural trends underlying the growth. I don't see that that's going to change the need for this sort of standardization, certification and traceability. All these factors, they're a part of the way industry and, you know, the global economy works now, and I would have thought that's going to continue. I think Intertek, one of the larger players in this sector now, so recently growth has slowed a bit and the rating has really come down as well, and although the shares rarely look cheap and even now I think they're on about 17 times earnings, it doesn't seem too much for a company of this kind of quality, I think. So I think that it's one of those businesses that will reward patience by continuing to just quietly compound away. And that's the basis for my investment anyway.
Yeah, it does. It absolutely looks like a sleep quietly at night type stock, that one. I mean, you know, just a general sort of like long-term compounder.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, really. It was originally spun out of Inchcape in the late 1990s. So Inchcape, the automotive group, but Intertek now, much, much larger, much more profitable business than Inchcape, which actually I think does look decent value at the moment, but not quite the same characteristics.
Yeah. Okay, well, the last one on the sort of the industrial side, Bodycote, which does sort of like, I think it's coatings for sort of like all types of different, you know, products, particularly the hardened metals and stuff like
that. Yeah, heat treatment and things like that.
That's right, yeah. It trades on about 11 times PE. What's your sort of latest on this? Because, I mean, obviously, it's got sort of like a number of different sort of, you know, sort of growth areas. Aerospace, commercial's doing well, defence is doing well, but I suppose auto, it's doing well at the moment, but may not be so next year.
Yeah, automotive, I mean, you can see there could be a bit of weakness there, depending on how the kind of macro picture pans out. But again, his company is quite a big player, I think, globally in this sector, especially more in developed markets. And I think the strength from aerospace and defense is probably could be quite enduring or quite persistent for a while. And electric vehicles is another area where they're saying they're seeing some good demand. But I think one of the areas that's not flagged up so much in the results, but is probably making a contribution at the moment, is oil and gas. it's you know, there's quite a lot of activity there, and they're saying that the company has said that they're seeing some strong demand from that sector at the moment. So it's one of these situations. There is obviously a bit of cyclical risk, and you have to wonder when you look at the valuation and the history of the share price. You can see that it's never going to go up in a straight line. But the valuation looks quite reasonable to me, and the balance sheet looks healthy enough at the moment. So it's based on what the company's telling us and the bigger picture that I can see, it looks reasonably valued and in good health at the moment. And I don't see any reason why it can't do well in 2024 unless something happens to change the broader picture.
How come it generates such attractive EBIT margins? I mean, they're about 16%, 17%. And I did notice that the board are indicating medium terms, and only like 3 years. They're looking for 20% plus. And it just seems this is industrial. They've obviously got something unique here, some USP angle, because you'd expect it into industrial sort of markets that actually, you know, it's going to be a sort of 10% margin type business, but it's aiming for double that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you would expect too that it's quite an energy intensive business and all that sort of thing, quite a big capital base. But I think it's mostly partly to do with its model of being able to provide a standardized service in a number of markets. So I think for larger customers, rather than having to contract with separate suppliers in different geographies, Bodycote is able to provide comparable service in more than one location. And I think that's possibly one feature that it has to offer larger buyers, larger clients, I suppose. But yeah, I think the margins are a little bit higher than you might expect from an industrial business. And I suppose the we'll have to see if they can be sustained, then that is maybe there is more of a competitive advantage in the group's network and geographic footprint than is obvious.
Yeah, well, it says to me it's definitely got something. I mean, if it's 20% EBIT margins, it'll be higher than Intertek, which is just so like, wow, counterintuitive to say the least. But they're obviously doing something right. Now, moving sectors to sort of financials, insurers and asset managers in particular, this is probably the most hated sector in the market on big caps. And unfortunately, the UK specializes in it. So in fact, I don't think you hardly ever see dividend yields higher than the PE ratio. But we have three examples here. Let's start with L&G, you know, a monster sort of like insurer and an asset manager, sort of like £13.5 billion business. And I reckoned it does something around about a dividend yield of 9% and it trades on a PE of about 8. What is the catch here, Roland? It just seems such a slam dunk for anybody who has got a remotely, you know, medium term investment horizon here.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much my view, really. I mean, there's always going to be some risk with these big businesses. And I suppose perhaps with legal in general, you can look at just the scale of it. There's no way that we can really get any detailed understanding of what goes on inside the box, if you like. I mean, over a trillion of assets under management, all sorts of long-term illiquid investments, more than they used to have, and cash flow projections stretching decades into the future, £1 billion bulk annuities. You know, there's a lot of complexity to it, and the way I view it tends to be that you do have to have a certain element of trust. But again, this is another one of these businesses. It's been operating successfully for well over a century. In recent years, very strong record of profitability, you know, often managing a return on equity over 20%. So it's been a far stronger performer than the big banks. I suppose another risk is that the longtime CEO, Nigel Wilson, he's about to retire, and he's really been instrumental in developing the strategy over the last decade or so, moving into more alternative assets and more of the built infrastructure and that sort of thing. But really, I think looking at it, the recent results, you know, the company is delivering to its plan. There was nothing obviously horrible about it. I think it's a case of sentiment and just where we are in the cycle. People think there should be a lot of bad news to come out of financials. especially with interest rates rising and the economy maybe slower. But so far, there's not a lot of evidence of that happening. And as you say, legal in general just looks very cheap, really.
And it survived. Yeah, it survived the LDI crisis over a year ago. If it can survive the sort of the Liz Truss sort of induced sort of like financial pandemic, then it could probably survive anything, you'd have thought.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously interest rates are higher now, and that's a new thing for many younger people and more recent investors, but it's not a new thing for an organization like Legal in general. You know, they've been through interest rate cycles and every other kind of cycle, and they should, assuming that hasn't been forgotten, then all that stuff you would hope is factored in and understood, and it's not going to cause any nasty surprises. And perhaps, you know, over time, it higher interest rates and more of a normal environment might be favorable. It's hard to say, I think, from an outside perspective, but I don't see a lot to worry about. And it's well-established big cap, the balance sheet, the metrics they report appear to be as you'd expect or comparable with peers.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And certainly if you look into 2024, if the market's right and we do start seeing interest rates in the UK decreasing, then bond prices should act favourably, plus equities with cost of capital should also act favourably. And given the UK is the cheapest market in the world, then if their asset base increases, that means their fee generation off the back of it is going to higher. So you'd have thought they'll have a tailwind for that. If your thesis is right, that with a more positive sort of like, you know, investment environment for next year, which I also agree, then it should do okay, logically anyway. But
yeah, and I suppose in recent years, it's been true generally. The legal in general has looked cheaper than comparable US peers. So it could be just another aspect of this being a UK-centric business, even though much of its assets, a great portion of its assets are not in the UK anymore. It's much more of a global business. So I think it's a victim maybe of the state of the UK market at the moment.
Yeah. Another one, which is a sort of like a less well-trodden business, is Close Brothers, which is a sort of like a boutique merchant bank and lender and asset manager. I think it's got a net asset value of about £11, and it trades at less than £8. So it's trading at a significant discount to its net assets, and it sort of trades at about 7.5 times PE, and I think again pays, 8% dividend yield. So yeah, is it ditto?
Well, ditto plus maybe some self-inflicted problems, but I think they're in the past. But yeah, when you look at the history of this, as far as I can see, the last time Close Brothers was really trading below NAV was around 2008 time and hasn't really done since then. So it looks a depressed valuation. They've had some problems with a business, the litigation financing business they bought in 2017, I think. Really messed up with that. And they've had to impair pretty much the whole loan book attached to this business, and it's now being wound down. So that's really hit the most recent set of results. But as far as I can see, the rest of the business, the business lending, motor finance, and so on, are all performing pretty much as they have done in the past and consistent with what you'd expect. So I think it's another business that looks cheap and is suffering a dose of negative sentiment, because obviously the asset management arm's not doing so well at the moment. Profits are down, just as they are across all the asset managers. So this is about as close almost to deep value as I might get. It looks like a real value situation. I can't see. It's been operating a long time consistently through the cycle again. Didn't cut its dividend in 2008. It's not like the big high street banks. It's historically been much more profitable. I think it's hard to say that there's not some value here at the moment, unless something really unexpected is about to happen.
Yeah. And also, you'd have thought just in that whole sector of asset managers, if you believe there is growth in people's savings, then there should be growth in the industry. So, you know, it should be able to. If it's cyclical growth given a tailwind, then they're not value traps at all. They can't be, because you know they've got, hopefully, unless they've got a sort of like a real damaged business model, which neither of these have.
No, so, I mean, I think this could be a bit more of a shakeout with active asset managers, and you know, the fee pressure on fees is kind of well documented. But I don't think you can say this whole active asset management section is going to disappear and be replaced by by passive and other stuff. There's got to be a role for it, I think, especially anyone with more of a specialist approach. And yeah, I think there's quite a lot of value across asset managers probably.
Okay, another one in the sort of the financials, but a more sort of specialist is Spreadbetter IG Group. And obviously they've got always, you know, sort of regulatory risk. And I know we chatted about it last time. It still trades at roughly around about seven times PE, I think. You know, pays a good dividend, really strong balance sheet, you know. Will this ever re-rate at all? It's just a sort of like a perennial, real, you know, you just got to hold it, pick the dividend up and just keep it as almost like a, you know, bond proxy almost.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny one too, that it tends to do well, obviously, in volatile markets when the its trading clients are much more active. And so company says that it's still got very high levels of client cash, but clearly these clients aren't trading as much at the moment. They're just sitting on cash in their accounts waiting for better opportunities, I suppose. So its results have been a little bit subdued and growth hasn't always been consistent in the past. But as you say, it's hugely profitable. Operating margins are about 40% plus, you know, high returns on equity and doesn't need a lot of capital. I've owned it for a while and it's quite nice to have when things are going pear-shaped, because you tend to know that IG's results will be quite strong next time around. And with a 7% yield at the current price, it seems all right to me, really. I think one concern, or opportunity and concern, is the options business they bought in the US. They did seem to buy it really at the peak of the market a couple of years ago. And so it's not clear to me how profitable that is yet. That arm of things, but the business as a whole is growing and diversifying a bit, and it seems pretty decent value at the moment. 7% yield and a PE of seven.
And I think they're taking out costs as well. And I mean, they did say, I think in their last trading update, they're going to take out about £50 million worth of cost, which, looking at their top line, means that's another 5% of EBIT margin, that is.
Yeah, I think they're cutting quite a lot of headcount to do that, aren't they? Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. And they've just got a new chief executive, or they're looking for a new permanent chief executive too. There's an interim boss at the moment. So again, whether there'll be a bit of a strategy update when that happens.
Yeah, well, as I say, all three of those sort of financial stocks, I mean, if you're looking for a value, that is deep, deep, deep. That's right at the bottom of the Atlantic value shares. Okay, now moving to another sector, luxury, Burberry. And this is one of the few, I think, in the UK, which sort of like, you know, reaches this echelon of sort of like super brand for the sort of like, you know, the seriously wealthy. What's your sort of latest on this one? Because it's sort of like, you've got a number of moving parts. You've got China. Everybody was hoping it was going to be a massive reopening. It's been less so. Europe has sort of like spluttered a bit, to say the least, with luxury. And now US is also sort of like, you know, slowing down. It trades at roughly around about 14, 15 times PE, but it's got a decent balance sheet.
Yeah, really good balance sheet. And as you say, but a decent luxury brand, although I think it's not quite at the very top of the luxury sort of pyramid. Yeah. It is well up there. But I have to admit, when I started looking at this and making some notes for this, for us to talk, I thought I hadn't really realized how far Burberry's share price had fallen over since earlier this year. I think at about £17, just under £17 now. It's well down there. And historically, I've tended to sort of look at this below £20 as being maybe interesting on a long-term view. So maybe the opportunity and maybe the risk here is that the focus on this Britishness of their brand is their kind of marketing strategy. And then maybe that doesn't quite have the cachet of French and Italian luxury, but it's been around a long time. As you say, very good balance sheet and always been, you know, decent margins and good cash generation. So I don't see much risk in buying a luxury brand like this with 14 times earnings. It doesn't seem to be pricing in too much future growth. But the new designer who, Daniel Lee, I think his name is, who started not that long ago, he seems to have had a favorable reception to what he's been, you know, to his early stuff. And there's a stable team now of CEO and designer that hopefully will complete this turnaround process that's been going on for a while. So supposed to be a victim of circumstances. And as you say, China hasn't quite exploded back into life in the way that people hoped. But a good business at a reasonable price, I think I'm happy to be patient if you can, you know, from buying at this level. So something I'll just wait and see, really. It's outside my kind of personal sphere of knowledge, but I know it's I know it's a decent brand, and it's been doing this successfully for quite a long time.
You haven't got one of their checked trench coats?
No trench coats.
Yeah, exactly. I think is it Emma Watson still sort of advertises them from Harry Potter? I think she does.
Yeah, and there's quite a few younger high profile people they've got marketing them now.
Well, I know Nick Train from Lindsay Train, the UK equity fund, is one of his favorite stocks. So I think you're in good company there. And it wouldn't surprise me at some point, you know, LVMH or Gucci or Hermes, you know, decides to put the slider all over them at these sort of prices, because it's a trophy asset, isn't it? And there aren't many of them around. So these guys like to collect them, certainly. Now, coming a bit further down the sort of the it's sort of homeware in the sort of the luxury chain is Dunelm. Now, my wife absolutely loves these guys. It's her go-to place. Great value, good product at a fantastic price. So what's your sort of outlook for Dunelm? The trade's at about 14 times. I don't know whether there's a lot of shrinkage going off, people thinking their products.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I see Dunelm as probably one of the best of the listed retailers in the UK market. You know, we often talk about Next as being a really good operator, and obviously they are. But to me, Dunelm is comparable, really. One of these companies that delivers what it says. It has a clear strategy. The finances are always strong, lots of cash generation, very high returns on equity. And I think there's still room to grow. They've been expanding into furniture and some other kind of adjacent areas over the last few years. And I think management say they've got about a 7% share of UK homewares and furniture markets. Mm. And although there's a lot of stores around, 7% sounds, you know, I would have thought there's room for a bit more growth out of that. Mm. And like you say, good products, reasonable prices, and margins are always well managed, clear guidance, and a growing presence online as well. I think that's about a third of orders now. So they invested in technology. I think they were starting to invest just before the pandemic, and that turned out to be a bit of maybe fortuitous timing, because they were quite well positioned to scale up their online activity during the pandemic. I know we were ordering things from them back then online too. And I think some of the deliveries took a bit longer than usual, but it all came through and it was all fine. Yeah. But I think at the moment, about a 10% free cash flow yield. They pay lots of special dividends. Last year, I think there was just over 80p paid out in total with the ordinary and a special. So that's a trailing yield of about 8% at the moment. Mm. And if, you know, it wouldn't be impossible to, I think this year might be slightly less, but it's been a nice income stock for me, and I think really well run business as well, which is always nice to see.
How recession resilient is it? If we do go through a sort of like a harder cycle next year, and also with the overlay of increasing Chinese sort of competition, I know it's more fast fashion that, but it's only a matter of time before they start offering, you know, the stuff that Dunelm sells may come from the Asia. And I mean, it's not out of the question that the Chinese competitors also start selling the same things, because they're obviously going through deflation, and they just sell them out at, they don't aim to make any money. They just want people employed.
Yeah, I mean, obviously selling online, it would be probably easy to compete with them on price. But yeah, I suppose there's a degree of risk that people will either buy less or buy cheaper and so on if things get worse next year. And if housing is more sluggish, then maybe that will affect sales. I'm not sure how much of it would be. I think most of this is everyday stuff. It's not really tied to house moves, but that is probably a catalyst for a bit of extra spending generally. Yeah. So it's one of those things where I think we could see a bit of softness, maybe a little bit more than is currently in the forecast, but nothing catastrophic. I think it is a well-established brand in the UK market, and the stores are mostly on retail parks, which is a format that seems to work well now, better than high streets, or it's been more resilient than high streets.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, my wife has got a lot of brand loyalty for it, and my mother-in-law as well. So it just makes an easy decision for them. Now, moving, a beneficiary actually of the cost of living crisis and sort of hot, tougher times is Money Supermarket, which has come back quite strongly. And they had a trading update just recently, and I think they're starting to see, you know, continued growth in that insurance market. You know, for sort of like putting offers and. How do you see this business sort of like, you know, looking into 2024?
Yeah, it's funny. No, Money Supermarket. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. It's because a few years ago, I think I was beginning to kind of have some doubts, really. I was looking at it and thinking, you know, the growth of the price comparison site seems to have come to a halt. They're all much of them, you know, all offering quite similar services, and marketing seemed to be more reliant on gimmicky adverts and so on than anything else to attract new customers. It's your meerkats and all the rest of it. And then obviously the pandemic, they lost a lot of business on travel, disappeared obviously. And that's then energy switching, that pretty much dried up, and that thing that still has. But your Money Supermarket seems to have come back really strongly, and they insurance business, home insurance, I thought, and motor insurance has been better than expected, I think, after last year's regulatory changes to do with price walking. And although, and personal, I think higher interest rates have probably created some more opportunities, even though some lending is a bit more restricted, I think, than it was. It's harder to get credit products possibly. But yeah, I think they seem to be able to, they seem to be generating growth internally again, whereas, which is really, that was the key driver, I think, for the valuation. What I was worried was before that they weren't able to do that. They were having to acquire it and, you know, debt was rising and so on. But that's all reversing now. The business is growing again. They seem to be in good health. I think they've maybe persisted a bit more with development internally and with marketing. They seem to have a lot of marketing going on at the moment, and it's one of those things that's performed better than I expected, and I've kind of come back around to it, having previously become a bit more cautious about it. So good. I think it's just in good shape and getting some tailwinds after a long period where the market was really more of a headwind, or where external conditions were really more of a headwind.
And will it be a sort of like an AI beneficiary or a potential sort of victim in going forward as sort of like, you know, you have more sort of precise sort of searches or discovery, as they call it, through AI, through generative AI?
It's hard to say, isn't it? I think you would imagine that they will use AI internally, and maybe you can imagine it might be used, for instance, to provide a more bespoke service to customers with accounts and with some existing data about their activities. I don't think it's likely to become a big threat. There's a lot, you know, there's a degree of brand loyalty, or certainly brand recognition, with Money Supermarket. And their approach of trying to get customers to build a record, you know, an account with a record of activity, allows them to become, you know, allows them to offer something a bit more personalized. And there's also regulatory things as well with so many financial products. So it's possibly something that's not so easy to commoditize and to do, you know, without the same infrastructure and investment behind it as Money Supermarket. So you can't be certain, but it doesn't seem to me like it's something that's a huge risk at the moment.
I would agree. I mean, it's growing and it's doing well, so I think it's probably one of those things that you can equally be a big beneficiary in terms of the types of services they offer and the data and the intelligence it gives their particular users. But equally, if somebody came up and tried to actually replicate it, that it all depends on whether they could move that traffic and those users to other services. So it could be either way, I guess. Now, you've got quite a few distributors in the portfolio, or in, you know, selections. Let's start with Kitwave. And I did notice that the CEO founder, Paul Young, he's retiring as well, I think, in March 24. These guys do sort of like the distribution of ambient and frozen and just normal sort of like products to convenience stores. So, you know, your local shop down.
Yeah, your corner shops and so on.
Corner shops down the village. And it keeps on knocking out the numbers, doing buy and build. What's your sort of like your latest on this one?
Yeah, as you say, Paul Young is recently said he's retiring, and I guess that means he may sell some of his remaining shareholding. But he's built up this business since 1987, and you know, I think it's got a really strong track record. A lot of the growth has been acquisitive, it's probably fair to say, but they seem to be able to maintain decent returns on capital, decent cash flow, which suggests to me that you know, there's a good discipline and process within the business when they look at how they're going to expand, what the opportunities are, and what price to pay. It's one interesting thing about it, I think, which is that as well as they do specialize in small orders for small shops and for small cafes and things like that too, which is a selling point. But they do actually have some really large customers. I think that B&M is one of their top two or three customers. I think they supply chilled stuff to them. And one or two other large buyers, including, I think, actually another wholesaler who they supply either chilled or frozen to, I forget. But so it's just that another one of these businesses that's actually performed well since its IPO. It's not been a disappointment at all. The shares have come down since the summer, but the latest results have been in line. And back in July, I think guidance was upgraded for the year. So it's another one of these businesses. It seems a well-run business. It seems to be performing, doing what it said it would do, but the valuation is down. And It looks interesting. I think at the moment the yield is up to about 4.5%.
Yeah.
And although it's low margins, as I say, it's high returns on capital and good cash generation, which are the key things for me in an operation like this.
And it should have inflation protection as well, shouldn't it? Because you know, they're making a margin on the distribution when they get economies of scale.
Yeah, and it's a lot of small everyday purchases all the time, stuff that tends to carry on one way or another.
Yeah, and then nine times PE, as I say, with a near 5% dividend yield, it's certainly not expensive, that's for sure. A slightly larger distributor, DCC, which again doesn't really get much air traffic or, you know, sort of like news over the media wise. They came out with their interim results strong. The shares are up about 5% today. So I think they're around about sort of like £50 now. They trade at still less than 11 times PE though. And they've just made a quick bolt-on acquisition in Germany for their energy business, distributing sort of like, I think it's more sort of like renewable energy type products and stuff like that. Do you want to take us through your latest one on this one? Because obviously it's huge and it distributes fuel, IT and technological products.
Yeah, I mean, the German acquisition, I think it's an LPG supplier, and it's a good example of how the energy business has grown over the years, really with a lot of roll-up acquisitions. And I think in Germany, they're targeting LPG, solar, and kind of energy management. And because obviously the one risk, I suppose, looking at this is that the energy business drives most of the profits, and most of that comes from fossil fuels of one sort or another, petrol, diesel, heating oil, and LPG, and so on. So in terms of the transition, they're really kind of pitching it that there'll be biofuels, there'll be gas, and there'll be things like solar. And also there'll be a need for energy management to help energy users, especially kind of small and medium businesses, manage the whole picture in a sensible way. And that's where I think DCC is trying to position itself there to reduce its outright dependency, I suppose, on selling a lot of petrol and diesel. But over the years, it's been a steady performer. It's constantly adding new small businesses to it, and generates a lot of cash. Again, it's not the most profitable business in terms of returns on capital, but it's been very, you know, very stable returns for a long time. I think 29 years of dividend growth, and a kind of fairly coherent strategy that hasn't changed too much, I don't think. Technology and healthcare are the other two. Outside energy are the other two main areas, and they are down a little bit. I think you've got factors like destocking and changing consumer spending after the pandemic and the supply chain crisis. But it's a steady performer. It's not very exciting, but it does something useful, and it's got good scale and a good track record of operating well. What I suppose I should point out, really, for UK shareholders is it an Irish company, and it does mean it's subject to Irish dividend withholding tax, which isn't ideal, I suppose. But I think it's still an attractive.
Is there any way around that at all? If you put it into a SIP, because I know if you put a US company into a personal SIP, then you don't get the withholding tax. Is it similar at all? Is it always you're going to be deducted from it?
As far as I know, it's always deducted. I don't know for sure. I know that mine in an ISA is deducted, but
yeah, it would be, yeah.
Yeah, but beyond that, the honest answer is I'm not totally sure. Try and steer clear of with the withholding tax situations, because it's just a bit of a drag on your returns. But
you can sometimes claim it back, can't you? I know that, but you have to sort of like then go to the relevant local tax office and prove that you're a UK investor and say. But it all depends on, you know, you might get the emergency sort of like taken off your dividend emergency rate, and then have to play the normal local rate, I guess.
I think it's quite complex, and if you're for relatively small private investors, it's one of those things that you're not likely to, probably not likely to be very feasible, from what I understand. But
a bit of a headache.
Happy to be proved wrong.
Yeah, a bit of a headache. Okay, another distributor, but they're more on the sort of the digitization IT side, is Computer Centre, which I guess is moving more towards the value-added sort of reseller. It trades at about 15 times. And I guess it's sort of like it sort of benefits from secular growth in all that sort of the IT stuff with cloud and cybersecurity and now generative AI, I guess, helping clients implement that.
Yeah, so it's this, as you say, it's mostly historically a value-added reseller, but increasingly I think they have a lot of a big service proposition too, really. So it's they'll kind of design the solution you need, they'll install it, they'll configure it, and they'll operate it for you as well and support it afterwards. But you're right, a lot of recent growth, I think, has come from the move into the US, which has been maybe lower margin, but they've been supplying quite a lot of big contracts to hyperscalers. So that would be these really large cloud data centers and stuff like that. But for me, this is one of these businesses. I've watched it for years and I've always admired its progress and the kind of quality of its reporting. And I've never quite got around to owning the shares, but I have bought them earlier this year. I think it's one of those businesses very well managed. I think the chief executive has been in charge since 1994. I think he's the longest serving FTSE 250 CEO. The two founders are still on the board. They've got a big shareholding, about £700 million worth of stock between them, I think.
Wow.
So it's IT is real, a bit of a market leader in this sector. You know, they focus on large corporate and public sector clients. So they're not small. So they're dealing with, you know, they don't have vast numbers of big clients, but they're quite valuable, the ones they do have. And I think it's one of those businesses that always had a very coherent, disciplined strategy. And that is, you know, they regularly deliver ahead of guidance rather than missing it. And it's just a good business that's well run. When you look at it, obviously very low margin in terms of operating margin, but again, very high returns on capital and strong cash generation over long periods. So the latest update seemed reassuring to me. They're confident of delivering some progress this year, as they say. Cash is being released because inventory levels are coming down now after building up inventories during, you know, when the supply chain problems were hitting. So I think there's a good chance of another special dividend next year. The valuation is actually quite cheap on a historic view, even though it's not obviously, you know, not a single digit PE or anything. So I think on a medium term view, I'm hoping that it will be a good buy for me this year. Will have been a good buy this year.
Yeah. How important is it for sort of like management to have skin in the game? I mean, 700 million may be a bit excessive, but.
I think one of them, at least one of them, still on the board, but they're not so active anymore. Actually, I lie, both of them are still on the board. But Yeah, I think it's when you've got the founders still following the business and having a clearly having an involvement, and also such a long-running partnership with the chief executive too, that he's, I consider him as not far off being, you know, being a founder. He's been with the business since the late 80s in overall, and he's clearly, you can't really, it would be hard to separate him from the business, I suppose, and perhaps that's a risk in terms of succession because he's in his 60s now too. But yeah, I think it's a nice thing to have. You always hope that there'll be more consideration given to long-term strategy and to the preservation of value, and you know, and to how capital is deployed when you've got the owners involved in a business rather than just hired managers.
Yeah, I'd agree. And now the last one on the sort of distribution side is NWF Group, which sort of distributes fuels and I think ambient groceries again and agricultural feed in the UK. I think the margins actually are even lower, about 2% compared to the you know, the other distributors. And they're also going through a transition, aren't they, on the CEO? I think Richard Whiting is moving. And there's another guy coming in. So how do you view this one? Because obviously it's got a reasonably, you know, competitive moat in terms of, you know, its distribution and its network effect, but it is low margins.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a bit of a mini DCC in some ways, actually. And I have to admit, I don't own NWF largely, probably because I do own DCC. But NWF, yeah, it's another one that is nice business. The margins are kind of deceptive in a way because, as you say, under 2% operating margin, but a lot of the revenue on fuel and feed, but especially fuel, is basically just passed through with a fixed margin per litre added on top. Yeah. So you look at the return on capital, and that's typically in the mid-teens, and that's more of an indication, I think, of the underlying profitability. Obviously, they do take some risk with buying in inventories and selling them on, but the low margins, I think, are a little bit of a red herring. It's more of a profitable business than that number would suggest. Again, the fuel business really had record profits last year. We all know that prices, energy prices, rose very sharply, and they had enough scale and enough management to be able to manage their supplies, move them around the country, and so on. So they could really benefit from that strong demand on fuel, and I guess, you know, maybe pad out their margins a little bit more than usual, but certainly it was a record year. And now we're in a bit of a funny situation that profits are really coming back down to more of the trajectory they were on before the war in Ukraine started, when and energy prices spiked. So you're looking at a big drop in profits for the current financial year, which ends in May, and then possibly more of a flat performance the year after. But again, you know, it's business that's been doing consistently following a strategy for quite a long time, steadily growing, rolling up small fuel distributors into its nation, into its national network, and I think now the shares have come down a bit. It looks very reasonably valued based on its track record. And you never just know, a good little business.
Yeah, well, you might being a DCC shareholder, you might become a shareholder of NWF if they buy them, because it seems like definitely a sort of like a bite-sized chunk there. Now moving to a different sector, again fairly sort of like economically sensitive, house building. We've got Bellway, the big sort of UK national house builder, and there's been sort of like quite sort of contrasting fortunes between some of them. And we've had a positive statement recently from Taylor Wimpey, but less so one, I think, from Redrow. And it's sort of like, how do you sort of view this sector as we look into 2024?
Yeah, I think Redrow are suffering because their buyers tend to be at the top of the housing chain. And what's happening is that people further down the chain, their mortgages are falling through and stuff like that. So it looks like the chains are collapsing. And whether Taylor Wimpey is doing better because more of its buyers are at the lower end of the chain, I don't quite know. And so similar problems might be affecting Bellway, because they're more of a mid to upper market positioning in terms of price and so on. But I like Bellway, I suppose, in particular because it does have, I think, a long record and a fairly disciplined record in terms of managing its balance sheet and focusing on creating value over the cycles. It hasn't needed to raise equity or scrap the dividend for a long time, and it's got very experienced management as well. looking at next year, the mood music at the moment doesn't seem all that positive. The volumes in the market really seem to have gone down, and that's for a house builder, that's the big risk, really. They can cope, I think, with falling prices, but if sales volumes dry up and you can't shift anything, then it doesn't really matter. Yeah. What the price is, you're stuck with a lot of inventory on your balance sheet that you can't convert to cash. But I mean, Bellway, I think it's about 25% below its net asset value at the moment. I think that asset value was reported at about £28 earlier this year. So historically, that's a big discount. It's rarely traded at that kind of discount. The balance sheet looks okay. They've done a little bit of a buyback in recent months, which has been done below book value. So that, again, should be a positive for shareholders in terms of, being beneficial to net asset value per share. I think it's a company that will ride out the current situation and be well positioned to benefit when conditions stabilize. And I think now the rates have stopped going up so much, over the next 6 to 12 months, I'd expect things to reach more of a normal balance, because people always need to move and people want to move. And it's just the case of, I think, people having confidence that things aren't about to collapse.
I think the mortgage market, as you rightly say, is becoming far more competitive, and you're seeing rates sort of heading down to 5%, or certainly it's 5 to 6%, depending on what your time horizon is on a fixed rate deal. So that starts to become more attractive, and it would not surprise me now that David Cameron's in the fold that the Tories are actually trying to to sort of get themselves ready for a general election at the back end of next year in the autumn statements in about just over a week's time. If there's some sort of booster for the housing market somewhere in there,
no, I wouldn't be surprised.
I wouldn't be surprised. They've run that movie a few times, so it's something to see. All the house builders certainly look very cheap. So if you've got a long-term view, you should be able to ride it out. And I think Bellway has been through that many a time, so it should be okay. Another one is James Latham, which is a sort of like a family-controlled timber merchant, building products. This, obviously, they specialise in. They try again at just over 10 times PE. What's your sort of latest on this? Because they've got plenty of cash on the balance sheet as well.
Yeah, I mean, they've got masses of cash on the balance sheet. I think the last time I looked, they've got about net cash of about 50 million. So that's about a quarter of the market cap at the moment. And this is another really old business. I think it's actually been trading since the 18th century. So it must be one of the oldest companies on the stock exchange, on the stock market today. It's still family controlled. I think it's, it's well run. Disciplined strategy. It's a good reputation in the trade. I think it's on terms of being reliable and fair on pricing and so on. It's not the most liquid stock in the world to buy, but I think it's as a long-term buy and hold kind of investment, it's a pretty safe bet that when demand picks up, their trading will pick up again as well. And in the meantime, with so much cash on the balance sheet, I wouldn't be as surprised if maybe there was a special dividend at some point. And certainly it's just, it looks a pretty safe place to put some money for a long-term investment.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And as you say, it all depends on how your economic view is going forward. But if you believe that we're not going to have a really, really hard landing, then these stocks are just priced for that. So I mean, you've got plenty of upside. As you rightly say at the start, you've got plenty of safety of, margin of safety in it.
Yeah, I mean, the shares are trading just about at book value, and a quarter of that is cash. Mm. So, and the rest of it is probably freehold property and other things that may well be undervalued in such a long established business. So it looks cheap to me on a long-term view. It's just not something you try and trade in and out of, probably.
Yeah. Another one that is an economically sensitive area is Page Group, the sort of, ex-Michael Page business. Again, a pretty big business, over £1 billion market cap, trades about 13 times PE. And shares have been obviously hit because people are very concerned about the recruitment employment situation, I guess.
Yeah, I think they have been trimming some of their headcount, letting go some of their fee earners, and giving it, there is a bit more of a downbeat outlook for the current year and maybe next year. But it's been in business a long time, and I think returns have been a bit less volatile than from some of the other smaller recruiters over the years. Been in business since the mid-70s, and track record, I think it's not had that many CEOs over the years. It has quite a long-term culture, I think, quite a stable financial record. A nice geographic spread in different markets, not just exposed to Europe and the UK. Again, a good operator, reasonably priced, a decent share of the market. A balance sheet is in good health with plenty of net cash at the moment. Some of that's been paid out in special dividends, which suggests they're fairly confident that the drop in demand for recruiting isn't going to be too deep and too prolonged. So I think on a cyclical view, it's just nicely valued really for the next few years.
Yeah. And now just again, turning sector to, I mean, this is a cheap GARP stock, which should be a GARP stock, is RWS, which used to be a sort of, it's on AIM. It's one of the bigger companies on AIM, about 800, 900 million market cap. Trades at sort of less than 10 times PE with cash on the balance sheet. And I know it's been through quite a tough period over the last 12 months in terms of the advertising market, and therefore its customers have wanted less of sort of like, you know, language translation, which is their sort of bread and butter, and patent translation, because I think there's been a European issue in terms of in the first half. But how do you see this one going forward? I mean, particularly under the lens of sort of AI.
Yeah, I mean, the shares have absolutely collapsed really over the last couple of years. I think they're down about 60%, and I don't know whether some of that has been triggered by AI and people thinking, well, translation, you know, that's just going to be a non-business anymore. You're just going to put it all into ChatGPT. But RWS, I think it's a lot bigger than that, and the services it provides for clients are a lot. I don't think they're the kind of thing that can just all be replaced by a generic service. You talk about advertising and consumer businesses. A lot of what they do now is a sort of full suite of localization, I suppose you could say, managing their content across different platforms, different languages, different countries. And then in addition to that, there's the more specialized things like patent translation and financial and legal translation, that sort of thing, where there's a lot of regulatory and compliance risk that has to be taken care of. I think for me, the biggest concern is that they've been quite acquisitive in recent years, and that process of integration, I think the company admits it's not all completely done yet. They think it's created what they call technical debt. So basically, underinvestment in IT, they've got duplicate systems and things that need to be properly integrated and upgraded. But beyond that, I think it's a good business. I don't think it's going to be made redundant by AI. I think AI is used widely within the business already. I think about 60% of the words they translate are already translated by computer services. And for me, it's got a good opportunity to become one of the market leaders in providing these broader range of commercial services that can just be outsourced from large corporations. So I think one example they use is one of the big Coca-Cola bottling companies that operates in various countries across Europe and so on. You know, they can localize everything and make sure that all that content is updated and targeted to its different markets correctly and that sort of thing. So I think it's undervalued at the moment, and based on the current story and recent performance, which has been broadly in line. Again, it's another one that fell despite saying the results would be within the range of expectations. The founder is still on the board, still has a decent sized shareholding. So there's possible that he might look for an exit, I suppose. I think he's in his 80s now. And so it looks undervalued for me. It's always been a nicely cash generative. And if the company can do what it says and finish integrating the acquisitions properly and maybe boost margins a bit or recover margins to where they used to be, then I think there's good upside potentially from this one.
And they did talk about actually in their last trading update that they are doing it sort of training of AI models, you know, for large corporates who have got sort of like generative AI and then wanted to leverage their own data. If they want to sort of do a mass, that all the data is they've got is in one language. And if they want to basically have that generation, that generative AI working in multiple languages, i.e. the output tailored to the user using effectively, you know, in a different language to where their core data is, then they're getting involved in that training process to help those corporates translate that information into multiple languages.
Yeah, I think that's one of the opportunities with AI for a company like this. It's one of those things, you know, you've got, they say in IT, garbage in, garbage out. When these AIs, you need to, for corporates especially, they're going to want to be sure what the AI system has been trained on, that the data is of a certain quality, that it doesn't have any kind of hidden bias or linguistic quirks that could cause serious brand problems. So, I think being able to provide the data sets to power AI systems is an opportunity that RWS should be well positioned to support.
Yeah. Now, just finally, then we've got Jersey Electricity, which I didn't even know existed. So we're well spotted on this one. Now, it's obviously a utility. It produces, presumably, and supplies electricity in Jersey. And I did see, actually, that there is speculation that it was looking for a merger with Guernsey Electricity, which it denied and said it wasn't doing that at all. But what's your latest on this one? Because I guess it's a bond proxy, isn't it?
It's I mean, it is really it's a bit of a quirky business, I suppose, in that it's the monopoly energy supplier on Jersey, and it has some property interests and retail interest on the island as well. So it's all tied up in one place, and most of its electricity actually comes from France, from a contract with one of the big utilities there, although they are looking at becoming a bit more self-sufficient. So it's one of those things. It's never going to shoot the lights out, but the shares are trading at something like a 50% discount to reported book value at the moment. So even though returns have been, you know, the returns have been quite low historically, if you're buying at half book value, then your return on equity is effectively boosted by that, the return on your investment. So I think the valuation looks reasonable. There's a 4.5% dividend yield that I think has never been cut as far as I can see. So for more over 30 years anyway. And it's also one of these small businesses that's just plodded away in the background on the market. You could argue that there's not much point to it having a stock market listing, but it does. And it's one of the things that's been interesting over the last couple of years is that, you know, we've all seen electricity and gas prices really spike here in the UK, but apparently customers on Jersey, they haven't really had that. Most of their supply has been hedged right through this period. And they've only had really quite modest increases in their utility bills, apparently. And this is Jersey. The company seems to have managed it quite well. And I guess they have some advantages too from being a monopoly supplier on such a small island with a mild climate. Some of the challenges that you might face elsewhere aren't there, but you know, they're working on a plan to decarbonize energy on the island, and again, they seem to have a good strategy, a sensible strategy, some nice other assets as well, like property, which deliver complementary kind of returns. So it's a bit of a niche thing, but I think it's been a very reliable dividend for a long time, and now the valuation has come down. I quite like having a bit of it tucked away.
Other than M&A, how is it growing though, or how can it grow?
I mean growth is always going to be fairly incremental. Electricity usage has probably gone up over the years, especially as more buildings and homes are electrified. And less use of bottled gas and stuff like that. Ultimately, I suppose there is a bit of a limit on scale unless they can find new other local areas to invest in. It would definitely be a bit of a worry if I saw them investing in random other places outside the Channel Islands. You'd think that would probably be a risk of diversification, as Peter Lynch would say.
Yeah, you're probably right. Okay, brilliant. Now, just want to pick your brains in terms of sort of like what would be, you know, learning points really for investors in terms of what not to do in this type of market. I mean, I guess one being obvious is sort of like don't sell at the bottom if you've got a good long-term company. But other sort of things to avoid about, I don't know, buying or selling, or how do you sort of like, you know, something the investors should be aware of before they make a sort of like a big decision.
Yeah, I suppose obviously, as you say, the main thing is to not be scared out by falling share prices. if you're aiming to, if a company is doing what it says it will do, is doing what it's done before, and it's and it's delivering roughly in line with guidance, then from my point of view, it's more of whether there's a buying opportunity than a reason to sell. And so, yeah, not being scared out of the market. But really what makes it easier, I think, or what I try and do in these situations is you just look at the valuation against the historical context and against forecasts. Look at the fundamental health of the business, understand how it's performing and if it's still able to create value. And when you look at all these things, the share price seems less of a concern, and you can see whether there's, you know, you can see more, get more of an idea of what the opportunity might be. You know, longer term, those factors are what will dictate the share price and your overall shareholder returns. But I mean, it's easier said than done when you see a decent company report stable results and the share price drops for no apparent reason. It's uncomfortable, and especially if you haven't been through the cycle and the rebound afterwards before, then it is uncomfortable. But this is how you, I think this is where you can lock in value and future gains for. Sorry about that. Lock in value for the future, and that's certainly what I'm trying to do generally.
Yeah. And do you hold it, have you got any spare cash at the moment, or are you fully invested?
I haven't got much at the moment. No, I'm pretty much fully invested now. I think I do sometimes let cash build up, but I think if I'm looking at shares I already have and the valuations seem good, then my general approach is to top up if I'm not buying anything new. So no, I'm pretty much fully invested.
Yeah, well, that's a good statement of intent, that's for sure. I'm likewise. Brilliant. Well, thanks very much, Roland. If people want to sort of like, you know, get insights into the services that you offer, how best to do that?
Yeah, so all my stuff about, or the majority of my stuff about dividend shares is on my website, rolandhead.com, on Twitter at rolandhead, and so on as well. In addition to that, Stockopedia subscribers will see I've got regular stuff there, and also a model portfolio that's run on more of a growth focus. But yeah, rolandhead.com for dividend shares and my thoughts on what I own and other stocks in the market.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, well, thanks for your time. Great selection of stocks for people to go away and put the slider all over and look forward. Well, first of all, I hope we both are right. It's going to be a good 2024 because it's been pretty miserable for the last 2 years. And anyway, I look forward to touching base in 6 months' time. So thanks, Roland.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Paul.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.